Our schedule is a bit erratic right now, but the best way to find out when we're dropping new episodes of No Longer Neighbors is to follow us on Twitter. Our handle is NLN Podcast. That's NLN Podcast on Twitter. You can also interact with us that way. It would be great to find out what you want to hear about on upcoming episodes.
Woo! Yeah, No Longer Neighbors, hosted by Chris and Aaron. Used to live next door, Dallas, Texas, representing. But then Aaron moved away. Yeah, that's the situation. So join the podcast, get in on the conversation. Yeah, authentic, real friends, I admit it. Still keeping the connection, it don't matter about the distance. You don't have to wait up, I'ma tell you straight up. Entertaining for sure, this is No Longer Neighbors, yeah.
After an extended break, back with another edition of No Longer Neighbors. I'm Chris Mikoski. Aaron Arruda returns as well.
Yes, after a break, I am glad to see you're looking a little bit younger and fresher without the beard and the long hair. I think that means you had to go back to work.
Well, so when sports shut down in mid-March, not too long after that, I decided, what's the point of shaving? And I'm not going to go get a haircut. So it'd been growing nonstop since mid-April with a beard. Hadn't had a haircut since late February. Yeah, I was looking kind of crazy. But high school football for the larger schools got started back up here in Dallas-Fort Worth last weekend. And I'm the sideline reporter for the game of the week on the local CW affiliate. And my boss there was very clear in that you're not allowed on the air with that thing. So it had to go. And I'll retweet the before and after that I put up on my personal account. Go to NLN Podcast on Twitter and I'll share that with everybody. But it had to go, and we had Flower Mound Marcus against Dallas Jesuit on Friday night on CW 33. And then I went over for my first college broadcast of the season, Louisiana Tech hosting Houston Baptist in Ruston on ESPN3. And the Bulldogs coming out on top in a high-scoring affair, a lot of offense. So glad to be back to work, and unfortunately, your work situation has changed as well, and that's something that we're going to be praying for you and praying for Alicia to get that up and going in the right direction very soon.
Yeah, so I'm newly entering the job market this week, so things are going to be concluding at my current gig, and I am officially looking, so definitely prayers for me and prayers for the family as we kind of figure out what's next. But, you know, on topics that affect everyone, I think that what's fresh on everyone's mind, especially when we're recording here, is the presidential debate that happened last night. And man, I don't know if it makes me feel better about any situation that anyone is in right now, because I think we all think we could probably use some stability in the country. And I think that the debate, just to get it kicked off here, reflected anything but stability.
I saw a lot of friends this morning. We're taping on Wednesday morning. Basically saying, judging based on all of your guys' timelines, I'm glad I skipped that. And I think perfect world, I'd take that hour and a half of my life back. But for the sake of the podcast, and really, you know, it's a train wreck, and I can't look away. As much as I say that was a waste of time, I'm going to watch all four debates, all three presidential and one vice presidential. Not that it's going to change my mind on who I'm going to vote for. And that was my biggest question coming out of that thing.
Yeah, I have
some
hopes.
Did that change anybody's mind? The only thing I think it might have changed is whether people even want to bother voting for either of them. That might drive more people to saying, screw it, I'm not going to the polls at all.
Yeah, I mean, you wonder, right? Because I think that there were people tuning in that wanted their minds to be changed, right? They wanted to see maybe a more stable Donald Trump than they've seen, to think that, hey, maybe, you know, I can vote for him. I think there were people on the other side, probably more people overall in the country, that were looking for a steady Joe Biden, mm-hmm. and just wanted him to demonstrate that he was ready to lead the country despite some of the discussions about his health and his kind of mental well-being. And I think we got a little bit of that. I mean, we can talk about that, right? I mean, I don't think that the debate was a disaster for Joe Biden from a, like, being up there, being incoherent. But it definitely, you know, didn't lead me to think just personally that, you know, this guy is overwhelmingly sharp and confident. There were moments where he seemed to correct himself a lot, which is one thing I noticed. Like, he would say one thing, then immediately sure. after he would kind of correct it. And there were some moments where he seemed a little bit unsure of himself. But overall, I mean, it was from the beginning, it was just a disaster. And kind of starting with the talking over each other, which I know is one of the big subjects that came out of the debate, unfortunately, I heard somebody say that it was like a kindergarten Zoom meeting. So if anyone...
Except you can't mute the other person.
Yes. If anyone has had the luxury of sitting next to their child during any virtual schooling, especially the younger children, right? I mean, this was like... just talking over each other. But the problem is, these are not kindergartners. They're the two men that we are, you know, facing off to lead our country. And it's kind of sad and disappointing that they can't follow rules that they agreed upon.
Their camps agreed upon. I don't know how much input either one of them had, but I don't know where to start exactly with the critique of all this, other than my wife quoted Michelle Obama last night at one point, when they go low, we go high. That didn't happen. Biden stooped to President Trump's level on a few occasions, calling him a clown, asking him to shut up. I wish that could have been done in a different way. I'm not sure how. I mean, obviously the way Trump combats Biden in that situation, I don't know what you could have done differently, other than if you just be silent, then he's just going to walk all over you. You have to come back somehow. But some of those retorts felt like, you know, like I said, let's rise above, let's be better. But I don't know what I don't know what you could have said differently.
No, I agree. I thought that the, you know, will you just shut up, man, I think is what he said, was the mm-hmm. quote. And I mean, it was like, we're talking less than 20 minutes into the debate, and Joe Biden is already telling him to shut up. I was kind of surprised by that, but it really did seem kind of off the cuff, just like Joe was getting very irritated.
Right.
And so in some ways, I think some people will like it because it shows some realism here. It's like, what would happen if you were in a situation where somebody would just, you know, kind of walking all over you, and they, you know, I think there's a bit of realism. But you're right. I think that if Joe Biden wanted to come out of the night and say, I'm the adult in this situation, that there are probably a couple of things that he could have handled a bit better in how he responded. I think you can be firm without name calling. And I think that would be the preference, is still to stay away from name calling.
Yeah.
Not because of what he said is not true, but because that's what we get with Donald Trump.
I mean, is it better, I guess, a perfect retort, as opposed to you never get a second with this clown. You know, this clown has no idea what he's doing. Something, sir, is my time. I mean, but that's hard to do consistently when it's
sure.
And, you know, Chris Wallace made it very clear, you know, he was good to stand up. I mean, he's probably the best person in that role in the current realm of people in the news. I mean, he has credibility. He can hold it down the line. He can speak truth to power. You know, when Trump is basically calling him to, well, you're not doing fairly, like, in due respect, sir, you have interrupted a lot more than Mr. Biden has. You know, I think the fact that who his employer is helps too. I mean, the fact that, I mean, I don't think anybody would say that Chris Wallace is like 99% of the other personalities who are on the air on Fox News, but still having that employer gives you the sense, I think, where people on the Republican side were like, all right, well, at least he's going to be fair to our candidate. If this would have been a moderator from MSNBC or CNN, then you would have everybody on the right saying that, all right, this guy obviously wasn't fair. He's, you know, clearly in their pocket. But
well, yeah, and they're still saying it, right? I mean, they're still saying it. So, you know, Chris Wallace, for those of you who don't know, you know, he's the son of Mike Wallace, I believe, veteran journalist family. He's worked for four different networks. So Fox News is not his first employer. He has voted for both Democrats and Republicans, he stated in his life, though he is a registered Democrat in Washington, D.C. that works for Fox News. So he's kind of the most, like you said, middle of the road person you're going to get. Unfortunately, I see some people, one, blaming Chris Wallace this morning on social media and last night saying that he couldn't get control of them. I'm not exactly sure, short of cutting the mics, which looks like it was not agreed to by the
debate. If he would have had the mute buttons on both sides, that wouldn't that have been great if he had one on mute button on Trump's side, one on Biden's side?
But I assume that was not agreed to by the you know, debate commission or by the parties, right? So he didn't have that power. I'm not sure what else you're supposed to do when the president just won't stop talking. There's really, I mean, is he supposed to like stand up and scream at him? I thought he handled it the best that he could or the best that anyone could.
Yeah.
And I didn't think it was a deficiency in Chris Wallace. I'd like to see anyone else try better, especially in this first debate.
The next one between the two presidential candidates is a town hall forum, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not sure the format on the third.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I did see, I don't know if you saw this, Chris, last night President Trump tweeted a graphic after the debate that showed him on one side versus Biden and Chris Wallace on the other side. So he obviously thought that Chris was not being fair and coming after him.
He just liked the graphic and thought it would rile up his base, like so many other things that he puts out on social media. I don't know that there have been plenty of things where I don't know if he really believes or he just thinks, oh, here's more red meat to throw to my people. But the biggest probably it came near the end to where he has the wide open shot. We're going to get into the NBA finals in a second. The wide open shot for President Trump to denounce white supremacists and airballed it. I mean, he could have so easily have just said, I denounce white supremacy in all forms. Instead, he spouts the line that is now the new catchphrase for the Pride Boys, stand back and stand by.
Yeah, nobody really knows what that means. I don't know.
Well, other than, you know, he hasn't made it. He has not said that he's going to accept the results. He's waiting. He's talking about this rigged election. And does that mean that he is going to call on people with something after election day saying, you make sure we protect our country. Let's get out in the streets. And I have no idea, but it's scary. I know the suburbs are going to go away, according to President Trump, right? If Biden gets elected, we're living up in the suburbs. So hopefully, at least for the next few months, the suburbs stay put and we're okay. But I do worry about big cities and potential unrest, and really unlike we've ever seen in the course of the aftermath of an election. I think there could be major issues.
Yeah, and I'm still one of these that thinks that the violence that is thought to be possible is probably a little bit overrated. I'm not sure we'll even see anything to the level that we saw in the latest riots and protests earlier this year. And while those were massive, I mean, they were nationwide, don't get me wrong, they did primarily, at least the violence, primarily took place in inner cities, which is what happens in a lot of cases, right? People generally congregate in downtown. So the whole like threat, you know, moving out to the suburbs or whatever, I'm not too worried about that. But I do think that if Trump wins, as we've said, there's going to be a section of the population that thinks that this was rigged based on his, if Trump loses. If Trump wins, there's going to be a section of the other side that talks about, you know, some things that he's done in certain areas to either stronghold or rig the election, right? So either side is going to have that. I think how widespread it is depends on two things. One, how close the election is, right? If this comes down to just a few votes and we're, like we talked about, counting mail-in ballots a month later and it's coming down to, you know, that kind of stuff. And two, it also comes down to just how many examples, if there are examples, come out around election time on either side of things being awry, right? So he talked about the ballots in the trash can during the debate. If there's a lot of those things, right, that's going to rile people up.
Some of it, though, that he brought up last night was completely fabricated.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm going to several fact-checking websites, which, you know, I think some people on that side would say are in the pocket of the left or whatever, but that's again another worry of mine, that it's all, that a lot of this so-called election fraud is going to be something that is rumor and goes, and but President Trump saying it in a briefing will make it true to some people.
Oh, absolutely.
That's what we're worried about. So, you know, the back and forth between about the $3.5 million from the Moscow mayor and, you know, I think the most real that you see anybody really, and you and I as parents would be defending our children. And obviously he had that, Joe Biden had to do that with Hunter for a part and admitted the faults that he's had, but denied everything that President Trump was throwing out in allegations. And then the way his face changed when he talked about Beau. And I think it would be the same for me. You're basically saying that what he stood for was wrong, and, you know, all these things that he supposedly said that came out in the Atlantic article, and he completely was, I think, the same way I would be doing, trying to defend the honor of my child. And that was a very real moment for me, and the fact that Trump was kind of rolling his eyes at it was another one of those childish moments last night.
Yeah. I mean, this was expected. They expected that President Trump would at some point, you know, get into the discussion of Joe Biden's kids. And I just think it's a place that we don't really need to go in these debates. That's my opinion. I mean, if Beau Biden or Hunter Biden in their past were doing these things clearly, and I want to say clearly, on the behalf of, on Joe Biden's behalf, right? Like if they were his right-hand man, kind of like Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump have been working, you know, in Donald Trump's businesses, and they did something clearly at his direction, at Joe Biden's direction, that was illegal or something like that, then I think you can talk about that, right? It's a business transaction,
right,
behest of the father. But when you're just talking about the actions of their children, kind of independently, I think that's kind of crossed the line or over the line.
Well, obviously, President Trump was trying to frame it in that he was receiving these benefits because of who his father
is. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Well, nonetheless, I'm exhausted thinking about it. I mean, I don't want to talk about this anymore. I probably will turn off Twitter for the rest of the day, except to post, you know, the notice that the new episode has dropped.
There you go.
We will do that on NLN podcast. So ESPN is calling right now fall frenzy in all of their promotions. Because of all the delays, because the way the sports schedule is, it is the wildest time that we've ever seen across the sports landscape. We have NHL Stanley Cup Final just wrapping up. We have the NBA finals starting on Wednesday night. The baseball playoffs started on Tuesday. We have golf majors back to back to back to back. And that's on top of college football, pro football. In our world here in Texas, high school football is almost just as big of a deal. So I honestly am trying to keep up. You know, obviously I'm the biggest sports fan, you know. But I can't even keep track of all of it. We can start, I suppose, with the Stanley Cup final, just because we're here in Dallas, and big disappointment that the Stars lose in six. But at the same time, with it being in the bubble, without games being here in Dallas, I was not as passionate about what was happening as I would have been had it been here. It felt somewhat disconnected.
Yeah, when you can't go to the game, or not all your friends are going to the game, and there's stuff around town, it doesn't have quite the same feel. But I do think that anytime a team from one of the four major sports, let's say, goes to, you know, their final, it's a big deal for that town.
You wouldn't be as excited if FC Dallas reached the MLS Cup?
I would be, but not quite as quite as excited. It would be close. It'd be close. But I mean, I know that NHL is probably the lowest in popularity of the four major sports, if we call it. But it was very cool for Stars fans. I think that the story that we take out of this is Dallas is you need to cherish one, even in odd seasons, the time that your sports teams get to go to the playoffs, because that's special. But you definitely, when they get to go to the finals, it's like a whole nother level of wow, we'll remember this. Because obviously when the Rangers went to the World Series twice, it didn't end the same as when we got to see the Mavs win with Dirk, you know, a while back. And so any appearance, I think, is just great, especially when the team exceeds expectations.
And they certainly
did that, right? So it was an exciting ride. But it is always sad, especially when they were really close. I didn't follow the series super close, but I know that there were some very controversial calls that could have impacted games.
Yeah.
And if some of those calls, you know, have gone the other way, I'm not saying for sure the Stars would have won, but it's a possibility for sure that we could have seen a different outcome of the series. And so for them to be that close, it's heartbreaking. But I think most Stars fans are really proud of the Stars for how far they made it this year.
No, and my hockey year, the highlight was going to the Winter Classic. Nothing better than that. And that I'm just so looking forward to whenever we get back to being able to go to hockey games and everything else in person again. And certainly if you're going to have a year that falls short and gives you the expectations of potentially making it back to the final the following year, which the Stars will be favored to do, I'd imagine, given that run and given who comes back and more stability on that team going forward, that, you know, hopefully we'll be able to have in time for the next Stanley Cup final, a packed American Airlines Center. NBA finals start Wednesday night in the bubble. Again, we're taping this on Wednesday morning. So next week we'll have our impressions of the Heat and the Lakers at whatever point they may be in their best of seven series. Honestly, when the Mavericks got eliminated, I pretty well tuned out of the NBA Finals. I'll come back for a deciding game, but with all that's going on, this is one of the least of my priorities. I've never been a huge NBA fan to begin with. I'm a big college basketball fan, and I honestly follow the Legends, our local G League team, more than I do the Mavericks. More family-friendly budget as far as entertainment going to basketball games. But I'll tune in for a deciding game. How much are you going to be locked into this?
Not much at all. I mean, I looked on ESPN today, and I think, like, the headline was a poll asking, like, if LeBron loses, will his legacy be tainted? And I'm just like, seriously, guys, is this what we're talking about after all this time? One, if it's LeBron, well, it's a team game. It gets a little bit tiring to me. But two, LeBron's legacy, I think at this point, no matter what you think of him, should be pretty well cemented.
Yeah.
I mean,
he's taken his team to the final round constantly over and over and over again. I mean, that's, I don't think you can ever, I'm never going to fall into the camp where he's the best ever. I think Jordan's got that locked up for all time, but LeBron's right up there. I mean, it's consistent greatness, and there's no denying that.
Whatever team he's on, there's no doubt that he leads them to the finals. I mean, I haven't looked at the stats, but I mean, goodness, almost every year, every other year, the man has been there, right, for a very long time. So
something like 10 of the last 14. It's crazy.
It's ridiculous. So I just thought that was a little bit ridiculous. I'll watch it, like you said, maybe if it gets down to game 6, game 7, yeah, and it's pretty tight, you know, I might watch it, but I'm not too worried about it. Baseball, though, talking about things that I don't watch, you reminded me yesterday that we started the baseball playoffs already. Is this what has happened?
Tuesday, yeah. Mid-afternoon, Astros versus Twins started us off yesterday, and I watched almost the entirety of that on my second screen. I mean, I'm not watching, you know, every single pitch, but I'll have it off to the side, and the Twins had a defensive lapse in the ninth inning and blew it. Astros picked up game one, and this opening round is just a best-of-three series. So you work all year long, and your season could be over after just two losses. And then after this opening round, which is hosted by the better seed, everybody goes into their bubbles. So we'll see two teams come here to DFW, to Globe Life Field in Arlington, to start the NL divisional round. And then the winner of that will stay put in Arlington, be joined by the winner from the series in Houston for the NL Championship Series. Winner of that stays put to face whoever survives from the American League playoffs out in California. So it's about to start getting very interesting in Arlington. Rob Manfred, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, still says that he's trying to find the right plan to let fans in the stands for the World Series. Which, you know, the Cowboys just down the street from Globe Life Field are allowing, I believe it was 50% capacity for their home games. Mm. We saw their first home game a couple of weeks ago.
There were 30,000-ish people. Okay. So I think it's actually about one-third capacity.
Okay.
And they're looking at the total capacity if you include, like, suites and standing room.
There you go. So if that's possible for the Cowboys, I don't see why it wouldn't be possible for the World Series. But then again, it's going to be an odd situation to where, unless it's the Astros and those fans can travel easily, you're going to tell people a week out that you can travel to Arlington to watch your team in the World Series. That's going to be tough for most people to turn around. Then you've got potentially seven games worth. I mean, unless you're giving tickets away, are fans in DFW really going to care if it's Padres versus Rays? I mean,
I think fans will turn out, but you're right. I don't think they're going to pay a ton of money.
No, especially if it's like I said, two teams that have nothing. If it's Dodgers versus Indians, that's not much of a Metroplex fan base for that.
Yeah. I mean, it will be smaller, though. Let's just say you go by the one-third rule, right? If you were to go by that rule, baseball stadium's a lot smaller than a football stadium, right? So your attendance – you don't need as many people, and there will be some fans who travel. So I don't think
maybe
I'm
discounting it. I guess I should think of like big events like Super Bowl and Final Four. So a lot of people do go to those regardless of who's playing. They just want to be part of the experience. But at the same time, those are things people can plan for a year out. Whereas this might be, you know, you find out you get and get fans in there a matter of days before it happens.
I think you're right, though. I don't think like I would pay, especially during COVID, you know, $200 a ticket for my family. So $800 for a family of four to go watch some team I didn't care about.
Right.
But if baseball's just like, hey, we want the World Series to be, you know, attended and we're going to sell these things for dirt cheap, that might, okay, I could go watch a World Series. So,
yeah. You know, perfect world. Again, maybe this is a stupid idea because of COVID, but you just give away the tickets to local little leagues and let kids enjoy it. But, yeah. you know, but then again, do you really, if you're MLB and there's a COVID breakout among local yeah, youth baseball players, do you really want that on your hands? Probably not. Well, let's get into our interview. It's kind of, we've had some sad shows before. We've had some deep shows before. And Andy Cook is our guest on this one. It's certainly a deep conversation about her new book.
Yeah, I don't know if we've ever had a podcast, like you said, that is quite this intense. We did keep it on the high level, though. We tried to look at this book, which is a very good book, and talk about lessons and the positives and things you could bring out, because Andy has been through some absolutely horrific situations in her life, none of which are enviable. She makes clear in the book and in the podcast that some of these situations are of her own doing, but she has definitely had some folks in her life that have just absolutely taken advantage of her and hurt her in many ways. And I think a lot of us can identify, whether we're male or female, throughout our life, there maybe have been people that have, you know, not done right by us in our relationships. And so that's what we dive into with Andy today.
Yeah, and you use the word intense. I think probably the best word to describe our conversation, really what she's trying to do, it's all about healing. Here's our conversation with Andy.
Andy, thanks for joining us. I'm glad to have you on the program. I've had a chance to read most of your new book. Can you tell us the title of the book and then just kind of an overview? It's a really intense book. I know that. But just kind of an overview for everyone of what the book is about and just kind of hit the highlights.
Absolutely. So my book is Up From the Ashes, and it is a story of overcoming trauma, tragedy, and loss throughout my life. And so something that I really felt challenged in was to tell a really raw, vulnerable account of problems that I faced, things that have happened to me, things that have happened because of me, and to be very real and raw. And I have a heart for just having tough conversations within the body of Christ. So it's a very faith-based message of hope and of healing and a focus on what did God teach me through trauma, tragedy, and loss that we can apply. And even if you haven't faced exactly what I have, I think there's still relatable messages in there that you can walk away and go, man, I could apply this to my life and feel like I could navigate a conversation or a difficult situation.
I think there are a lot of people who go through really tough times like this who would certainly be reluctant to be so open. Aaron and I are definitely kind of on your same wavelength, Andy. If you go back and listen to some of our shows talking about tragedies that we've faced in our families and us personally, just when did you kind of realize that this is what I need to do? This is your calling. I assume it was all a matter of prayer for you.
It was a matter of prayer. And my journey, well, I guess we would go back to when I was a teenager. And so I had survived abuse. I had survived the suicide of my biological father. And I promised back then that I would one day write my story. So there's just kind of the seed that was planted so long ago. But back in 2017, when I was battling anxiety on a different level, I actually started writing this book as a journal called Getting Out of My Own Mind. And that was the name of the book up until I got the cover art like this year. So I had been writing it, journaling, but I really honestly wasn't ready to publish it yet. I would get to these really difficult parts of the conversation or the, you know, kind of healing process. And I would say, insert story here. And I would like move on really quickly past it. I wasn't ready to have those conversations, even with myself, to go through the motions. And I think sometimes we have to give ourselves grace and healing, or grace in our healing process, I should say. And there was a time like my son was going to the Mayo Clinic. He had had back-to-back concussions in football. And he was just going through a really hard healing process with that. And I shelved the book thinking, I don't know if I'll come back to this. And when I made this list at the end of 2019 of the things in my life I had started but not finished, the book became number one priority. So about 3 days before the new year, I said, you know what, let's get it done. Let's just write the first draft. I think I'm ready. And I guess 25 hours into the new year, I had a first draft of a book.
Wow.
And it's very different. I call it the roughest rough draft ever because I was not ready. But when I worked, I partnered with a really good writing coach / editor who was able to tell me things like, hey, I think you should dive deeper over here. Or I don't think we can publish this until you get healing in this area. What do you think? And she was so real and raw and honest with me that it made me a better writer. It made me a stronger woman of faith. It made me ready to start a business. It kind of, this was the closing of the door of my past and opening the door to a new chapter that so much in my life has changed since I said, hey, let's publish a book. I've started a company that's thriving. I have, you know, a whole new facet of my life that I didn't have any clue was coming.
Yeah. So throughout the book, one of the things I found interesting is that you had a lot of reasons to probably walk away from church. Yeah. There were a lot of people that either treated you the wrong way or your biological father was involved in church even through times of abuse, right? There was just a lot of reasons. Yet throughout the book, you seem to come back at times to your faith. And it obviously concludes with that. What has, you know, the faith part of your journey as part of your bigger journey, like meant to you? Because it seemed in the book like it was something you were always struggling with, even up to the time of writing.
Absolutely. When I first started writing in 2017, I was going to do it positive thinking, like The Secret kind of law of attraction. I was really studying that because I was looking for a truth. But I didn't really know where God fit into the God that I had been taught through some very kind of hard line religious doctrine. And I didn't know where I stood with that. So going into 2017 and even up until last year, I would have told you I didn't know where I stood in my faith. And I come from a family who is very grounded in their faith. And all I knew was I wanted to figure out who God was. And the only time I felt like I could truly experience the presence of God was when I would get out of my house and go out into nature and think, okay, God, I feel you here. I can see you here. And so I began to kind of explore that, but it wasn't until losing my grandfather. And I actually keep going with that in the story. I don't know if you've read the part about my grandfather, but so I was in the room when my grandfather passed away, and leading up into this moment, I was terrified of everything death related. I had never viewed a body at a funeral. So you know how at the funeral, people will go up to the front, pay their respects. People would go up to the front and I would go out the back. Even for family, I was just not comfortable around anything like that. And so as my grandfather began to move into hospice, I made a commitment that I was going to usher him into eternity. I was going to be there for him and I would process my own feelings later, but I didn't want to miss these final moments. This man had been a pillar of faith in our family. He had, everybody was talking about this legacy of faith, only I was sitting there silent. Nobody knew how deeply I was struggling with my own belief system. And as we sat there and I'm praying, you know, God, I don't know how I feel about you. I don't know what I think about you. I believe you're there. I just don't know how you fit into what I've been taught about you. And so as I, and at that time, you know, I still didn't really understand what happened after life here on earth. And so my mom comes running out of his room and said, he stopped breathing. My sister runs for the nurse. I run into, you know, into the room and sit on the side of his bed. Well, it's very common at the end of life for patients who are dying to stop breathing and start breathing again. And so he had started breathing. He's looking around the room. He looks at my mom. He looks at my sister and then locks eyes with me. And we are probably 6 inches from each other. And I take his face in my hands and I just say, everything is going to be okay. And I could see this fear. And once I said, everything is going to be okay, he looked past me. His eyes lit up. He saw something. He smiled and he was gone like that. And I never again could question my faith because I watched him transition into something else. I saw him see something past me. And I thought, man, he gave me a legacy of faith that I could never deny because I witnessed something with my own eyes that would have terrified me. But God used this tragedy to teach me something beautiful about who he was as my savior, as my creator. And so I believe that kind of catapulted my journey to rediscover, okay, what do I believe about God? And when I changed my prayer life from, God, I want this, or do this for me, or I need this, into, I just started praying, God, I want my heart to mirror your heart. I want to know who you are, and I want to be an extension of your love to people. No judgment, no religious doctrine that you have to do this to earn this. I didn't want any part of that. I just wanted to know who God was. And in that discovery is where my true faith, but it was rooted in these moments from childhood and youth that there were truths in God that were planted in me that grew, but it took me some time to really discover what I felt about God for myself.
Hey, Andy, that about your grandfather just really resonates with me. I can't tell you how often I prayed for people in my life to have that moment where it's just undeniable that God is there. And I've had it in my life. I've felt the physical presence of God with me. The moment I was saved, okay, I felt it. I felt him pushing me to my knees when we were at our lowest point in our life, me and my wife. And at that point, I mean, no matter what little things creep up in doubt, I have to come back to that moment. Like, no, I know you're real. I know you're there. There is no question about it. And I just wish that moment could come for everybody.
Yeah. And it so often happens in our hardest, darkest moment where we're going, it's like everything else is stripped away and it's just you face to face with God and you experience him in a very real, tangible way.
Yeah, that's awesome. Me reading the book, I probably have a little different perspective just because I'm a man, right? And so
sure.
I was reading it through your eyes, which very much you've had very like female heroes and influences, and you talk about that some in the book. But, thinking about your relationships, which you're very open about your relationships with the men in your life, whether that was your father and your stepfather, and then, right, the husbands you had. Mm-hmm. If you're talking to men, specifically Christian men, because we've been talking in that context, sure, what advice would you give them about their relationships with their daughters and their spouses and kind of the impact that they can have for the positive or the negative? Because obviously you've had both, but unfortunately there's been a lot of negative impact from right, decisions that men around you have made.
And I would have to take ownership in some of those decisions as well, but sure. I would say, and I love this question, and that I think the dialogue starts with understanding that your words have power. And so I always say your words have power, speak life. And when you think about what you teach people, either through your actions or through your words, then it equals sometimes perpetuating beliefs that people have. So where if I... as a younger person, when I met a man who treated me as if sex was a priority, then that perpetuated the beliefs that I had had since childhood about my role as a woman. So it wasn't until stepping away from the dating scene and going, God, tell me what you feel about me. And so I would say as a man, one, be very cautious about perpetuating beliefs that women have. And identify those beliefs, not just from a place of brokenness, but how can I show you an extension of the love that God created me to show you? I use an example in the book called The Bank Account Principle. I actually use this when I'm teaching job seekers how to network. It applies to every area of our life. And essentially what the bank account principle says is that when we come into a relationship, there is positive equity or negative equity depending on our past experiences and life views. So as we're looking at that from a positive or negative equity, I think it may not be fair that you're dealing with somebody who has an overdrawn bank account, but understand that when you come into their life, they may have had some really negative experiences. When you do something that is selfless in nature, so you do something that's all about them, take an interest in their activities, pay a compliment, or do something kind for someone, that's a deposit into that account. And then when you do something that's all about you, that's a withdrawal. So I see relationships fail most often when we take withdrawals where there's not enough equity in the account. So when you hear people say you're so selfish or you only care about one thing, it means that you're making a withdrawal where there's not equity. So even though that may not feel like a fair statement, I think sometimes if we take a step back and what is our goal? So do we need to win this argument or do we need to build a relationship here? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think that's a great principle. I did see that in the book. And, you know, the people can get the concept of, you know, making a withdrawal where you maybe don't have any funds left, right? And
absolutely.
That applies obviously to both sides, right? Men and women.
Yes.
But kind of as a follow-up to the advice to men, as you said at the beginning, not everybody's going to be in your exact situation. And hopefully they won't have some of the unfortunate circumstances that you had because, you know, it's been quite a bit. But what advice do you give, and I know this is a heavy one, to women in those situations, just at a high level, in maybe not continuing in the path that you did for a while?
Absolutely. I think one thing is to step back away from the moment, away from the situation you're in, and stop looking at it from a point of view of what has happened to me, but what is my ownership and where can I take control back? So if I'm looking at life as only what has happened to me, I feel very out of control. I don't see how to make a way out of this, right? I'm only responding to life. But if I take ownership of my situation and I take ownership of I am in the relationships I choose to stay in, I live in the house I choose to live in, I have the job I choose to work in, and I look at that, of course there are things that happen to us that are beyond our scope of control. But if we look at it from how can I turn this around? How can I take ownership? Where can I trace back the root of this brokenness? Then I think that's step one. Step two is to become a safe space for yourself to explore. And in the book, I say a phrase that may be my favorite phrase in the book about ending an abusive relationship with myself, that I can't be the person that says the worst things about me. And so if we aren't a safe place for ourselves to explore thoughts or doubts or fears, I think that applies to men and women of not being the person that says these horrible things. Oftentimes, men replay what they see, women replay what they hear. So it's the voices that we hear over and over. It's those negative things we replay, where oftentimes men are more visual and can replay the things they see.
Aaron, as he mentioned, has read the book. I've unfortunately only been able to get the cliff notes from him. I'm doing too much reading for grad school right now to dive into anything else. But from his cliff notes, one thing that really stood out to me was the importance of tribe. And you know, as again we talked about in a previous episode, after my wife and I have gone through miscarriages and through stillbirth, she found an organization called Hope Mommies that has really been an incredible source of help, of fellowship, of everything that she needed to help her heal. And,
absolutely.
You know, perfect world. I think I would probably want to establish something like that for men who have gone through something similar, because I can't find that kind of resource for men right now. But to talk about what you've gone through, the tribe, the fact that you've been able to do this with other people, you haven't had to deal with this alone. What has been the biggest impact in that and having that tribe?
So the relationship part didn't come natural for me. And that was something I had to learn to trust that people were not just seasonal, that they weren't just here for a temporary time and then they would go. While I do think there are some people in our life that are seasonal, I had to stop and look at the people that had been there all along, that it's easy to overlook that when you think everybody has left me or I feel very isolated, I feel very alone. Having gone through miscarriages, having one at 20 weeks, I get it. And I would say there are not enough resources. What shook me, what rocked my faith more than anything else that I have ever faced, more than abuse or more than failed marriages, would be losing that child. And I said in the book, if wanting him was enough, I would have a baby. And so I do have a child that's 20, but you're amazed at what people say in the heart of being helpful. Like, you know, simple things like, oh, well, at least you have another child. And yeah. They don't realize the wounds that that creates. Yeah. And so I would love to see, you know, you having that. I know being part of the Raven's Light Foundation from its inception, a story here in Burleson of a little girl who passed earlier this year and helping them get established. That was one thing on her father's heart, was helping parents, or especially fathers who had lost a child. So I do think there's a need, and I think that's something that strong enough to grieve, strong enough to support other grieving fathers, is something that we need to embrace. And there's the stigma as society, even in 2020, that we put on men, that it's your job to be strong. And sometimes there has to be a time to step back and go, but it's also your job to heal. And you can lead healing in your family by allowing yourself to heal first.
I appreciate that. There have been times where, yeah, definitely where I felt the calling, where I did need to be the strong one, certainly. But sure. I think that has left some room to where maybe some mourning has not happened for me that has happened for my wife. And I've shut some things out. But nonetheless, it's a long-term process. I know nothing's going to be fixed in 6 months. It's very much something that's going to be with me for the rest of my life.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Aaron, go ahead.
No, that's fine. You know, it's a very emotional topic. The next question is kind of a tougher topic. And you talked about at the beginning about how, you know, you were writing this, some of the context is kind of within the church, right? Or speaking as a Christian to other Christians. And one of the quotes from the book that I thought was really interesting, where you said, "My entire walk with God changed when I started making better sexual decisions." And that is a question that might, or a statement that might make some people uncomfortable. Sure. But within the context of the chapter, especially, you talk about how the church has not done a great job at addressing these topics, probably because they are uncomfortable. So
absolutely.
What advice can you give to maybe young adults who are Christians? And is there anything kind of the church at large that you'd like to say about, you know, maybe this, I don't want to say you were blaming anybody for your problems, but these factors contributed to you not having a healthy view of what you were facing.
So I think one thing is we have to have those tough conversations. We have to start talking about things. And for me, one of the biggest identity crises that I faced had to do with my sexual identity and a belief that my job was to please other people and that I didn't have a choice. So I think having those conversations and teaching people, you have the right to say no, and you have the right to say no and be safe. So when you're exposed to sexual trauma from a very early age, especially by somebody who was also a pillar of your faith foundation, then you begin to connect dots that don't necessarily go together. So there were these cracks in the foundation I had to repair. When I had questions about sex, the church at that time was not a safe place for me to ask them. So it became this forbidden fruit of, well, I don't have anyone in the church to ask, and everybody out in the world is talking about it and they seem to be enjoying it. Let's get their advice.
Sure.
And so when we refuse to talk about something, we also lose the right to control the narrative. So if we want to teach healthy sexual decisions among our young people, even single adults, if we're looking to have sexual relationships that are healthy and within God's plan for sex, then we have to understand the laws and principles about this gift that he gave humanity and why he created it the way he did. And it's the connections we create with people that, even though in society today, we are taught that you can separate your emotions from it. You can separate the spiritual laws from it. It doesn't have to be this deep connection. And I think the title of that chapter is You Can't Defy Gravity. We can't take away God's plan for sex. We can't take away the fact that it connects us. And yeah. So I think for me, understanding, because sex was such a deep insecurity for me, and understanding that God could handle that part of me and understand that I could be honest with him about my struggles, about my feelings, about my thoughts, my doubts. That's really what was a pivotal transition of learning there wasn't anything in my life that was off limits for him. So as much, I think that was as big of a revelation as much as the actual learning the deeper aspects of how he designed sex and why he even cared about my personal sex life.
So that's a great answer. We know that difficult topics are hard for anyone to address. And I think the answer of the church, and even for some Christian parents for a long time, is if we ignore these issues, that they'll just go away. And that's not really the solution that anyone's looking for. But
sure.
When we talk about solutions, you have an interesting kind of twist or end to your story where there were a couple things that changed in your life, right? And so one of them we've talked very heavily about was a spiritual change. And as you kind of reconnected with your faith, and you talked about some events that happened there. But also, I thought was really interesting from kind of like a professional slash how am I going to get going? One of the pivotal moments in your life was when you started watching YouTube videos of all things. And yeah. I thought, okay, I mean, I watch YouTube videos, but they're mostly about, like, I don't know, cell phones or sneakers or cooking or something totally.
Cats playing piano.
Things that I'm interested in that make absolutely no, contribute no value to my life. But that wasn't the case for you. So tell us a little bit about that.
So I was on a mission to really change my mind. I was having panic attacks. I knew something had to give. And I wanted to start thinking more positively and getting messages of hope. And so I discovered like these compilation videos on YouTube that would have all these positive messages. Well, then I started digging deeper, like, okay, who's saying that and what else do they say? So I discovered speakers like Eric Thomas and Les Brown, and Denzel has some great quotes out there. Will Smith has some fantastic material. There's so many. Les Howey's, Simon Sinek. So really just kind of diving deep into what messages are out there that could help me transform the way I think. And that's actually even a biblical principle of be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And so I knew if I could change my mind, I could change my life. I felt like I was trapped inside of my own head. I was an overthinker. I was paralyzed by fear and anxiety most of the time. And so it really was this mission, this quest to go out and discover positivity on a new level. And I literally submerged myself in it hours and hours and hours a day. As I was doing anything, there would be positive messages going. And I really felt like that was part of the process for me of going, hang on, I have to change the way I think. I have to change the voices that I have in my head of you're not enough, you're not worthy, you can't do this. And into this, you know, motivational, if you've ever heard Eric Thomas, like, he is in your face, there is no excuses, but I felt like I needed that. And so I was so thankful for those free videos that were out there. And then that turned into me reading more books and discovering Lisa Nichols and Brene Brown and some of the female leaders that at that time, it took me a while to get there.
So kind of in that same vein and leading up to kind of what you're doing now and some other things, you have a chapter in the book called Overcoming Roadblocks, or about overcoming roadblocks.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seems like you were on your way to making progress in your life, maybe multiple times, right? Like there's multiple times where it came to your mind that like something needs to change.
Right.
Obviously things are not going well. What can you get, or what advice can you give to people who kind of have some clarity about like, this is not right, or maybe even have even a vision of where they want to go, but they keep on kind of getting tripped up on that path for whatever reason?
Sure. I think a lot of it has to do with what are we willing to trade our dream for, right? We give it up for a new relationship, for a job, for the bigger, better deal. And we abandon what we've worked so hard for to pursue something that we think may interest us. We see somebody else doing something. We compare ourselves. We stop doing, you know, we tell ourselves we're not enough. We stop doing what we have been doing that's working to create this momentum. And we allow silly things to sidetrack us or completely derail us. And for me, it would be a heart wound, something that somebody said, a doubt that would creep back in, or, you know, something that would get back to me, insecurities, fears, all of that would come in and like totally derail me. And I would justify it as, you know, this or that. But in the truth, I was giving away my dream and my progress for something meaningless. And so I would say, stay true, stay steady, really kind of sift through what's coming at you. So many times I didn't achieve a goal because I just gave up too soon. And I think that's something that we do, even as a business owner, when things get tough, there were times that I would have already quit by now. And being able to stay through, I wouldn't be where I am today. We're currently, you know, doing our first kind of 12-day job seeker challenge where we're teaching people how to use tools and resources to go out and get jobs. But we have 100 people in that group. We wouldn't be there had I quit 2 months ago when things were like crazy and I didn't know how we were going to do this. So it's learning to persevere through those hard times and not allowing something insignificant to steal your vision or your goal or your work or progress.
And given everything you've got going on in running your own company, this is, you know, like you said, it's a passion. I mean, this is a project Absolutely. That really means everything to you. And I'm just curious, kind of to close things out, what has been the most impactful feedback that you've received from somebody who's read the book? And obviously it's made a big difference in their lives.
Throughout the book, I had this person in my head, and I don't even know who this person is. It was just this young woman sitting on the side of her bed, contemplating ending her life. And I literally wrote this book to her. And she was this like steady figure in my mind about going, if you can hang on, I will get there. So to have people come back and say, I felt like you wrote my story. I felt like we are the same person. I feel like you've gone through what I've gone through, and now I know that I can go through it too. Or them talking about reframing their thinking, or there's an acronym I use throughout the book called BOND, Be Open, Not Defensive. And when people quote that back to me, I think when I logged on to Facebook one day and somebody had posted a quote from my book and said that forgiveness is the most powerful tool I have to release the past grip on my future, basically. And so when I log in and see this quote on Facebook, there's just something very surreal about that, but very meaningful of going, okay, I was obedient. I did what I was designed to do. It wasn't about a book sales number. I took all expectations for that. I said I wasn't going to overmarket it. I was going to get it in the hands of the people who needed it and allow that to happen organically. And really more than anything, I think it was about finishing a goal. So then to hear all this feedback of how God is using that to help others has been very, very significant.
Andy, that's awesome. And I hope that every appearance you make on this show or any other leads another person to reading the story and leads it to a person who needs to hear what you have to offer. We really appreciate your time. And again, I'm sorry that I haven't had the time to read the full book, but again, Aaron did a great job with the Cliff Notes. I tell you that much.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was great to have you.
It's an honor to be here.
Thanks again to Andy for joining us for this week's episode. Of course, we will link to where you can find the book on Amazon in the show notes. Brooks Running Shoes is what we want to talk about in today's What We Are Into. As we mentioned off the top, Aaron has a little bit more time on his hand these days, and sounds like, based on what you want to talk about here, that you're using it productively.
Well, I'm not running, so let's just be clear. For those of you
who, I forgot you're still banned to the house with a boot. What are we talking about, man?
Well, not a boot. So there, I'll share a little bit of personal news here. So last Friday was a big day. I was able to take off the boot, so I was out of either a cast or a boot for the first time in 8 weeks. So for the first time in 8 weeks, I was able to put a shoe on my right foot, which was big news. And I essentially have to learn how to walk again, which is fun in your late 30s. To learn how to walk again, because I've been doing it for quite some time, and you think you know how to do it.
There's a Foo Fighters song with those lyrics, by the way.
Okay. I'll have to look
learning
it up.
Learning to walk again.
Yeah, well, that's my new theme song, I guess. So I had this wonderful pair of Adidas Pure Boost, and those of you who are not into the or Ultra Boost, actually, there's Pure Boost and Ultra. They're Ultra. That are into the sneaker game. I'm not really that into it because I'm not a big working out guy even before all this, but my wife had bought me these as a present to work out in. And so I had these really nice, really expensive Adidas that are like cool that I'd worn maybe a total of 2 times. And so I said, you know, through all this, I've been wearing casual clothes. I'm going to put on these Adidas. Well, there's one problem. These new fancy sneakers, and not just the Adidas Ultra Boost, they're kind of a sock-like shoe. Do you know what I'm talking about, Chris?
Yeah, I've seen them, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So basically the tongue, like on a normal shoe, doesn't remove. So you're it's kind of like you're slipping on a sock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem is when you're recovering from an Achilles injury and learning to walk again, even though I'm somewhat healed, my foot still swells and my ankle swells because it's getting used to that pressure again. Well, I couldn't even slide my foot into this really nice expensive shoe that I've been waiting to wear because it was so painful to get it in. So I did have to wear them once because it was the only shoe I had brought with me to physical therapy, and it was not fun. And I also noticed that while they're so spongy, you would think that the softest possible shoe would be great if you have a foot injury. It's not actually the case, because though it feels good and soft, you want something that has some support, because my ankles don't have a lot of stability. So this is one thing I had to learn about that runners have to learn about, which is having stability in a shoe, not just comfort. And so I did some Googling over the weekend. And I had heard and seen people wear these Brooks running shoes before. Most of them, in my opinion, were not exactly that fashionable. Not that most sneakers are these days, but I got a pair over the weekend. And man, I'll tell you, as soon as I put them on and laced them up, because these ones you can move the tongue, put my foot in there, the difference in walking was amazing. The stability in these shoes, while still comfortable, they provided support. And my ankle was just like, I felt like it was much more locked into place, not in a bad way, but like in a good way. The only thing that I'll say is that they do run, the specific ones I got, they're called the Ghost 13. They're their most popular model is the Ghosts. They have different models. So this is, I think, the 13th iteration, is that they're a little small in terms of lengthwise in the toe box. So they actually run a little bit wide. So you have room to spread your feet when you run, but they're actually a little bit short. And so I bought them through Academy Sports and didn't read the thing on Brooks's website where it says, order a half size up. But I wore them anyway. And I'm like, oh, I'll break them in. So 2 days into it, I'm like, man, I really should return these, and got a half size up because they're perfect for what I need. They're just a little bit short in the toe.
Yeah.
And so I go to Brooks's website and they have a 90-day guarantee, and I read about it and it says, even if you bought this from one of our retail partners, so I had bought it from Academy.
Right.
Let us know if they won't take them back, and we will within 90 days give you, you know, an exchange or whatever, 100% satisfaction. And so I had a 5-minute chat with Brooks on the website. That's all it was. And told them I could use a bigger size. They said, no problem, sir. We're going to ship you the size you want and here's a prepaid FedEx label to ship back the old ones. It was that simple. And so I was wowed by their customer service.
Yeah.
No third degree, no grilling, nothing. So I have a new pair of Brooks on the way. And they said, you know, go ahead and feel free to keep those until the new ones come, so you're not without shoes if you want to wear them. So I thought it was a great shoe and a great experience that I had never dealt with before. So maybe if you're in the market for either a running shoe or even just something to walk around in, you know, don't look at the flashier Nikes or Adidas's, but give Brooks a try.
I'm an Under Armour guy. I like their stuff all around. So from head to toe, really.
I would say I like their stuff from head to ankle. So I love Under Armour wear. I've never been fascinated by their shoes.
I've probably bought a new pair of Under Armour running shoes once a year for the last 5 years.
Really?
Yeah. I like them. And I almost buy the exact same pair every single time. It's gray Under Armour shoes. They match everything, basically. I'm happy with them.
Well, if you're using them specifically for athletics, I would definitely give the Brooks a try next time you're in the market. 90 days, you know, that's a pretty good offer.
If I can get the refund after I say, I'm going back to Under Armour. If you can give them my money back, I'll give them a try. Sure.
Well, that's it. That's all I got for you right now. And there's not a whole lot else of interesting stuff going on.
Well, you're going to get yourself into something interesting soon.
Yes.
We have a faith in that. And my most interesting thing, I suppose, is more high school football this weekend. So don't have another college broadcast for a while, but Friday night, if you're in the DFW area, you can watch on CW33, and really anywhere in the world, you can watch on CW33.com. Friday night, 7:00 Central Time, we'll have Frisco Lone Star versus Aledo. The Rangers are defending state semifinalists, and the Bearcats are back-to-back state champs. So really good matchup over in Parker County.
I don't know if I'll be watching high school football, Chris. I do like to go to the games in person, but if you're going to be there, then maybe I'll tune in. I do hope, though, that they can get you guys some like coordinating masks or something. I think that the medical mask look is just, I don't know.
See, I originally went there with a really nice cloth mask that my mom had sent me, really, really nice, and was excited to wear it. But I didn't practice talking in it during the week. I got out there, started having some conversations in pregame, and realized this is really difficult. I can't talk in this cloth thing. So I switched back to the medical mask, and it didn't, you know, I had it. The station shirt is navy, the cloth mask, you know, that kind of light blue. It coordinated fairly well, and I could speak a lot easier in it, which is the main point.
I guess we'll just be staying tuned to Dr. Chris on the sidelines. So
that's what you got for a while, at least. The guys up in the booth are separated, and same for me. When I was in the booth last weekend, I didn't have a mask on, but out in the elements with all these people around me, I think that's how it's going to be for a while.
Well, that wraps it up for episode 13. Until next time, and I will say until next time, I know we've been a bit erratic with the schedule lately, with Chris getting back to work and other things going on, and so we're just going to post episodes when we have them. I think that's our new mission, is when we have something to talk about, we'll be here. So until then, hope everybody stays well.